Well, I'll go ahead and just give a little introduction of myself. Tremaine Phillips. I graduated from Michigan State University in 2008 with a degree in environmental economics and policy and a minor in GIS as well as in environmental studies. I worked when I got out of the university for the Michigan Environmental Council, and actually, it's a funny story on one reason I got that job. I was on an airplane back from D.C., and I sat next to Brad Garman. He works at the Michigan Environmental Council, and that was kind of my first impromptu interview. So that's why I always tell students now, you have to always be ready with your sales pitch, because you never know when you may sit next to your future employer on an airplane for an hour and a half. But so I worked at the Michigan Environmental Council for about 2 years as Energy Program Associate there. I then worked for the Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth as the Assistant Deputy Director there, and we worked on a lot of Governor Granholm's energy policies and manufacturing policies related to clean energy before she left office. I now work for an organization that is very closely affiliated with Michigan State University. It's called the Prima Civitas Foundation. We are actually located just above Barnes & Noble, so if you guys know of the Technology Innovation Center, MSU Connect, some of those other university resources, we're based there, and we're largely a community and economic development organization. But we also have been working on a lot of initiatives relating back to the university on how do we empower, for instance, international students here at the university to take part in entrepreneurial activities. How do we engage Michigan State University alumni in bringing back economic opportunities to the state and helping out with international investment? So it's been a very fruitful experience I've had there, but unfortunately, I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of the Prima Civitas Foundation here today. I'm speaking more on behalf of my experience working here at the university and from my past experience working at the Michigan Environmental Council and from working at DLEG. So I want to make this very interactive. I would like to know, you know, some of the reasons on why you guys are here today. I love giving presentations about this topic and especially coming back to the university, but I'm really just giving an overview of kind of the present state of clean energy and of energy in the state of Michigan from a fossil fuel and an alternative energy perspective. And I just want everyone to have that base knowledge so that we can then, at the end of the discussion, have a little bit of a conversation about what the potential opportunities are and what are some of our future scenarios going forward. So if some people could just tell me, you know, what are your interests or kind of why you showed up here today. I know I heard one person, you said this is a class project or extra credit.
I missed a paper assignment, and I'm in an environmental ethics class here. Okay. At Briggs, so this is one of the most interesting topics I think that we discussed through the semester, so I wanted to come and listen to this today.
Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
I teach a 200-person lecture, and I get hammered about energy stuff all the time. I don't know anything about it, especially for Michigan. So this is, I'm going to ask you to come next semester.
That would be fun. No, and I may send you a bill as well. No, I'm just kidding. No, that would be great. And please, if you have any questions throughout, just go ahead and ask me. Nothing is kind of off limits here. So the first thing I want to do is just give an overall perspective of where Michigan's energy capacity currently comes from right now. I give a lot of presentations to elementary school children and to high school children, and I ask them, where do you get your power from? And sometimes they point to their cell phone. I'm like, all right, try again. They point to the wall socket. I'm like, try one more time. And eventually they'll get to the point of saying, okay, from a smokestack somewhere. But this is the real image of where in Michigan we get our power from. Now, I know it's pretty dark right there, but you can't see that big black portion on that pie chart is coal. So primarily here in Michigan, we get our energy from coal. We get it from about 19 coal-fired power plants throughout the state, larger size power plants. One of those power plants is TB Simon, located here on MSU's campus, just down the street there. The second portion we get is from nuclear. We have around three plus nuclear reactors located throughout the state. You probably have all seen the nuclear reactor if you're going down I-75 through Detroit. That's the Fermi reactor, so that's located in Moreau. There's actually two smokestacks there. There's Fermi 1, which was an old reactor that they decommissioned, and now Fermi 2, which is the reactor that's still up and running. And that's owned by Detroit Edison. And then we get a large percentage of our energy from natural gas. And we also get a small percentage from renewables. Now, the majority of that renewables number is actually from hydroelectric dams. So I will show some graphs later that show some of the percentages from wind and other resources. But in the bottom right-hand corner, I did this more for my reference than for you guys to be able to see, but that just shows some of the statistics for what where we get our electrical generation resources nationwide. So, again, 66% dependent on coal here in Michigan. We're about 45% dependent on coal nationwide. The second largest is natural gas nationwide, and then the third largest is nuclear there. And it goes on. So this is a really rough sketch of where some of our fossil fuel resources are located. Again, like I said, we have 19 coal plants throughout the state, and those are some of your larger coal plant facilities owned by consumers or DTE. We have three nuclear plants, and they have four nuclear reactors at those plants. And then we, again, have countless natural gas facilities. The Lansing Board of Water and Light, I don't know if any of you are from Lansing, just recently approved the construction of a new natural gas plant there in South Lansing, Old Town. And one of the reasons that many companies are moving towards natural gas is because it's cheap and because it has 50% less carbon emissions than that of a coal plant or some of your other heavy, intensive fossil fuel facilities. So you're actually probably going to see a trend more towards those natural gas, the construction of those natural gas facilities here in the future. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I just want to go through some of the main electrical generation resources and kind of give the good and the bad, just to give everyone a fair perspective on where all these kind of stack up to one another. In saying coal, I have to put the good in kind of quotation marks because I don't think I could live with myself or sleep tonight if I just said coal was good. But one thing about coal, you'll hear often that coal is cheap. And it's true that existing coal fire power plants are cheap. That's because many of them are from the 40s, 50s, 60s. It doesn't cost much to continue to run them. Buying coal is fairly cheap. So if you were to go and try and build a new wind turbine installation, but you have old coal already going onto the grid or onto the system, that old coal is many times going to be cheaper. Here in Lansing area, you pay 8.5 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And just tell me if this gets too wonky, but that's how much you're paying to get electricity from the grid. It usually costs a utility about 3 cents a kilowatt hour to put old coal onto the grid. So you can just see kind of how cheap that is. But there's reasons why it is so cheap. And that's because of these external costs. And you may learn about this in your ethics class. The external costs are what the cost of the coal pollution are putting onto the environment. What are the costs of actually extracting the coal resources? Usually the cost to our health, onto the environment, the social cost, and the cost on our climate aren't actually calculated into that price of coal. So that price of coal from those existing power plants would probably not be just 3 cents a kilowatt hour if it had to calculate, you know, my cousin's asthma condition, if it had to calculate the environmental impact on rivers and on natural resources in West Virginia or in Montana. If those costs were internalized, that existing power would be much more expensive than it is now. So another piece there is that new plants, so when we're actually trying to build new coal plants, those are actually much more expensive. Again, old coal plants, about 3 cents a kilowatt hour. New coal plants, about 13 cents a kilowatt hour. And I'll show you a little bit later why that's really important when it stacks up to other renewable energy resources. And then the other cost that you don't often hear is that it's 100% imported. We can't manufacture coal here in Michigan. We can't mine it here in Michigan. We have to import it all. About 80% plus we import actually from Powder River Basin, which is out in Montana, so out in the plains. We actually don't import much coal from the Appalachian Mountains, and that's because of the strip mining and the blast mining that they do there, some of the negative consequences of that, and also because that coal there has a very high sulfur content. And because of many environmental regulations, utilities don't want to use coal with high sulfur content. That means they have to use more environmental equipment to clean up that sulfur content. So you actually see countries like China, who don't have as strong environmental regulations as we do, buying coal from the Appalachian Mountains and using that instead of the Powder River Basin. Yeah. So this is actually an image of the natural gas facility that will be built in Old Town. And this is, I think this is actually an older image before it's kind of been redone, but it'll be a really fantastic facility. And when I worked at the Michigan Environmental Council, we helped to bring about the development of this natural gas plant. Essentially what has happened in Lansing is, if you've ever seen Lansing's skyline, you know that there's a very large coal plant located there, Eckert Station. Has a 300 600-foot tall stacks, the tallest thing on the horizon here in mid-Michigan. That plant is going to be taken offline within the next decade, and the Lansing Board of Water and Light needed to invest in a new energy resource going forward. And what the Michigan Environmental Council and many other organizations throughout mid-Michigan helped to propose was that natural gas, as well as energy efficiency and renewables, were part of the solution for ensuring that the Lansing Board of Water and Light did not invest in a new coal-fired power plant to replace the old one once it went offline. So because of a number of factors, the advocacy and it's just becoming much more expensive to build new coal, they've decided to go this route. So new plants for natural gas are cheap. They can provide backup for renewables. And like I said before, they have 50% reduced carbon emissions than many other fossil fuel plants like oil plants or like a coal plant. The bad, again, nearly all the fuel is imported. About 96% of natural gas is imported into the state. The price is varied. It's variable. And that's because what else do we use natural gas for? What are we using it for this winter? That too, yep, food. And we also use it for heat. That's the big one. So heat, if we started switching more natural gas to electrical production, what's that going to compete with? It's going to compete with the natural gas being used for heat, and therefore you're going to have price spikes on both ends, which people often see their price spikes in heat, and that, you know, wouldn't make consumers very happy. And you may have heard, I know I heard an article on NPR recently. There's a big article in The Economist last week. But there's also some issues with natural gas and its resource extraction. The word fracking has been promoted a lot more as of lately by the utility and by the natural gas industry as a potential solution for getting more natural gas from many of these reservoirs. It essentially involves taking water, sending it down into geological forms at very high pressure. You fracture the earth, and you're able to get natural gas up through those fissures in places where usually a natural gas well would not be able to tap into. But there's issues regarding fracking and its impact on water resources. There's actually research into fracking causing earthquakes in the southern part of the United States and in Europe. So it's something that has to be looked into as well. And then this is not the last fossil fuel resource at all, but this is, you know, just another major one we have in Michigan, and that's nuclear. Why people want to move towards nuclear, again, it's baseload capacity. You can have a lot of energy come out of a nuclear power facility. Technically, when you run a nuclear power facility, there's little greenhouse gas emissions from it. But that does not count the uranium mining as well as the construction of the components and the construction of the actual nuclear facility, which then has carbon emissions associated to it. The bad piece is that they are very, very expensive in the billions and billions of dollars. I know there's some facilities that are looking to be constructed in Florida, and one facility there for two nuclear reactors was about $12 billion. So just think of the realm of the conversations that you hear every day, and $12 billion is a very large figure for just one or two plants. The fuel, again, is 100% imported. Uranium is not something that we mine here in Michigan. There's actually a lack of trained engineers for building new plants because we haven't built a nuclear facility since the 80s here in the U.S., so people just haven't been getting degrees and being trained in it. So we have to import labor and engineers from other countries if we want to go that route. And, you know, I actually created this presentation well before what happened in Japan. But when things go bad, they can go very bad. Now, nuclear relatively has a safe record. But again, when instances go wrong, they can impact a very large area for a significant amount of time. Coincidentally, I was in Japan about 2 weeks ago. And while I was there, they were having reports in the newspaper about the impact of Fukushima, which was a nuclear reactor that was hit by the tsunami and earthquake there in the northern part of the country, and how the radiation was impacting rice resources in prefectures all around that nuclear plant. So they're really worried about the impact on exports from that country, as well as the production of food and rice, which is it's a staple of their economy and of their food system as well. And that book, I'm sorry, is from, you remember how I said Fermi has two reactors? There's a reason reactor one is no longer in operation. That's because it had almost a full meltdown, I believe in the late 60s or early 70s. Maybe someone here knows the date better than I do. But there was a book written about it. It was called The Day We Almost Lost Detroit. Again, it was not a full meltdown. And, you know, nowadays you guys can Wikipedia and read about the entire thing, but it's a very interesting case study there. So this map just shows, again, when I was talking about the cost of fossil fuels. Right now, we export probably about $31 billion from the state of Michigan in terms of fossil fuel exports. So again, we have to buy all of these fossil fuels to bring into the state to use. Most of those, most of that funding is being spent on oil for gasoline and petroleum. But about $1.3 billion per year are being spent just on coal for importing it into the states. And when you see this region kind of out to our west, that's where the Powder River Basin mines are located. And these are some images from the Appalachian mining operations. And as you can see, this is what they call mountaintop removal mining. So essentially, instead of out west where they participate in strip mining, there's not mountains there. They just kind of bulldoze things over. Here, the coal seams are actually within the mountain. They have to take the tops of the mountains off in order to get to each coal seam. So it leaves this kind of moonscape, and especially in an Appalachian region, which is very high in biodiversity and such, has long-lasting impacts. So here I'm just kind of explaining some of the reasons on why, you know, it's a good case to move away from fossil fuels despite it being viewed as cheap and otherwise. Coal also, and many other natural resources, have impacts throughout their life cycle. So the pictures I showed earlier were from the mining and extraction portion of the coal operation. Then you actually go into consuming the coal, which is at the coal-fired power plant, where you have emissions that can often impact human health and environmental health, and then also emissions are impacting climate, our climate system as well. And then what you even hear more rarely about is what happens at the end of the coal seam, or at the end of the coal cycle, which is where does all the coal ash after it's burned goes? And in this image, when you actually do some of the mountaintop removal, you have a lot of this liquid ash, and you have a lot of contaminated reservoirs that they have to dam up and hold a lot of this contaminated water that was used in the coal operations. And in 2008, one of those dams burst, and a number of that coal ash contaminant flooded a town downstream. But it just kind of shows that at each point of that cycle, there are degradations to the environment as well as to human health that must be addressed.
Who paid for cleanup?
That was a lot of the federal government in that one, as well as the TVA, which is the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a huge, huge utility in that area. But that was a lot of federal government cleanup. And it was very surprising when that accident happened how little attention it actually did receive in media. And I know many of us probably never remember it actually occurring today. So the last part on, you know, what's the good reason for moving away from fossil fuels, and this is the one that I work on in my extracurricular activities probably the most, is climate change. So in the top left-hand corner, you see that 88% of human carbon emissions are coming from fossil fuel resources, as well as the production of cement, which is a very carbon-intensive operation as well. So you can see that that's a very a large part of the equation when we're trying to deal with climate change. Many of you probably know or are aware of the correlation between CO2 and greenhouse gases and its correlation to increasing temperatures across the globe. So this just shows one of the ways that you measure and see that interaction play out, which is through core ice samples. And you can see the temperatures over hundreds of thousands of years fluctuate coincidentally with the increase and decrease of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's a very clear scientific correlation, strong correlation there. But this is these are the numbers that I really think about. And this is the number of or the parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. So that's where climate scientists really see what are the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere and what are the concentrations we should stick to in order to keep our climate stable. When I started doing these presentations, I remember the PPMs were about at 382 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. And again, they fluctuate throughout the year as well. But now we're at about 388 parts per million. So it's a steady increase from human activities and otherwise. The argument is over where exactly do we need to keep those parts per million to have a stable climate. There's an organization called 350.org, and 350 says that we need to keep, or we actually need to decrease our emissions to 350 parts per million to keep a stable climate. You go to the UN and some other organizations, and they say maybe it's 400 parts per million, 450. We're not exactly sure what it is, but what we do know is that carbon emissions are increasing at an exponential rate now. And if we do not begin to take actions to stem that increasing CO2 and greenhouse gas concentration in our atmosphere, we're going to have a number of varied impacts on our ecosystems and on our society. And it's unfortunate this graph is kind of blacked out on the projector there. Not sure why. But just talking about some of the consequences of climate change. Again, you can't relate one instance of a weather event or a climate event to prove the existence of climate change. Climate scientists instead look at the aggregate weather systems in regions and all across the globe and try and see whether or not those are consistent with what they predict would happen with increased temperatures and with increased concentrations of greenhouse gas in our atmosphere. So one of those instances that really shocked me was this past April. If you remember, this spring we had a really violent, if not the most violent, tornadic season in recent memory. And in April, this is around the time when the Birmingham tornado occurred, the Joplin tornado. But in April alone, we had 753 tornadoes occur throughout the U.S. in that month. And on average, I should say April there and not June, but on average, there is actually only 161 tornadoes in that season and are in the month of April. So it just shows how far off of the norm and above average that tornadic season was. And that is very consistent with what climate scientists predict will happen in a warmer, higher greenhouse gas concentration type environment, that you have more extreme events happening on both scales. You can have extreme winter events as well. And these are just some of the more global occurrences that have happened over the last several years that have really caused concern. There is the Pakistan floods where one-fifth of the country was underwater, coinciding with the heat waves in Russia, which really impacted their wheat crops. And they actually had odd instances of drownings there in the country, if anybody remembers. People were escaping to lakes and to swimming pools to go and swim. And because the Russians like to partake in drinking, there was actually a lot of drownings that were occurring from that. And it was a public health crisis there in Russia, again, all stemming from these really extreme climatic impacts. Amazon rainforest having the second 100-year drought in 5 years. And then recently, over the last several months, we've had the floods in Thailand that have really been across the news. So again, these floods, these occurrences, these events have all happened before, but they're now happening with more frequency and to a more extreme extent than they were having in the past. So I always have to apologize after giving that portion of the conversation because everybody looks really depressed. And undoubtedly things, we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that the future isn't going to be hard and that hard choices aren't going to have to be made. But we also need to understand that through innovation, through clear and smart policy, and through collective action that we actually can take part in changing, these really hindrous impacts on our climate system. So this is a policy that is kind of leading to some of those positive goals that I helped to work on when I started working at the Michigan Environmental Council. In 2008, Michigan passed what they called the Clean, Renewable, and Efficient Energy Act. And what that did was it created what they called a renewable portfolio standard in the state of Michigan, which by 2015 will require that all utilities in the state have 10% of their electricity produced from renewable energy resources. So essentially it's a mandate that they begin putting clean, non-greenhouse gas producing energy facilities on the grid. It also created what they called an energy optimization standard, which essentially mandated energy efficiency as a part of their systems as well. And then it also had integrated resource planning, which is something much more convoluted, but it just created a much fairer process for renewables to be placed on the grid and to compete against fossil fuel resources. And due to that legislation, Michigan has seen a fairly considerable increase in the amount of renewable energy investment and actual installations here in Michigan. I know it's very hard to see because in this region, we don't necessarily have a lot of wind farms going up in mid-Michigan and solar panels aren't going up on everyone's houses. But the impact of this legislation is having a very large impact on how utilities are planning for the future. And if you've ever been to the Thumb, anyone seen the wind turbines in the Thumb harvest wind turbines at all? Anyone seen the wind turbines in Gratiot, Cadillac? Okay, so they're popping up kind of sporadically across the state, but again, usually where the wind resources are, high population centers are not. So that's one of the complications of trying to explain to people how these devices work and exactly what the impact of them are on our communities here. So in 2009, before that legislation really had an opportunity to implement itself, we had about 15.6 megawatts of clean energy capacity online here in the state of Michigan. And just to give a perspective of that, Lauren, what is the size of the coal plant at Michigan State? Is it 100 megawatts?
60 megawatts.
60 megawatts, okay. So three times less than that coal plant we have right down the street. That's how much renewable energy we had in 2009. But by 2012, we'll have about 700 megawatts of renewable energy capacity online. And most of this actually, 95-plus percent of this is going to be from wind resources as well. So this pie chart here on the left just shows you where some of these renewable energy are what these renewable energy installations will be once they come online in 2012. 93%, it says here, will be from wind, 4.5% from solar, and the rest will be from landfill gas. So actually harvesting the methane on the landfills and producing electricity from that, and anaerobic digesters and biomass, which Michigan State University is one of the premier institutions in the world for developing research around anaerobic digesters and biomass and energy from those resources. And that map there that you can't see all too clearly is just where some of the locations of some of these new resources will be once they come online. And if you can see Ingham County there, there's no dots there, so it's not apparent where some of these resources will be. But another portion that you can't necessarily see is the amount of investment that's coming into the state due to this legislation. So since 2008, we've had $4.1 billion of investment into new businesses in the solar realm. And we've also had about $270 million of investment into the wind industry. And again, this is due to this renewable energy policy. And those are just some of the myriad of industries that have spawned are located here in Michigan that are producing wind and solar components and creating jobs for Michiganders throughout the state. Some of them are Michigan-based companies. Some of them are not. Like Hemlock Solar Conductor, I believe, is one of the largest producers of polycrystalline in the entire world. And they're based, they're a Dow spinoff, and they're based in Hemlock, which is right outside of Midland. So they're a Michigan-based company. So is Mariah, MasTec, Energetics is also a Michigan-based company. But some of these are very interesting stories, like this Energetics company. Their actual subsidiary, or their parent company, is actually a company that produces luxury yachts in Holland, Michigan. So they produce yacht hulls. And of course, after 2008, not too many people were purchasing yachts. I know I wasn't. So they looked at the composites for the yacht hulls, and they said, what else can we do with this technology? And what they found out they could do is they could produce wind turbine blades. So there's where Michigan's engineering know-how, its innovation, its technology, and its capacity can really begin to diversify some of these old industries, and they can find new life in the renewable energy industry. So I'll go into these technologies a little bit further. So this is actually a solar plant that you can see. It's located in Lansing. I encourage all of you to take a tour of it. It's right across the street from the Lugnut Stadium. It's owned by the Board of Water and Light. It's fairly small. I think it's 40-plus kilowatts, something like that. But solar is a good resource because it's distributed. That means that instead of having power all located at one central site like we do here on campus, you can distribute it around many different locations. You can distribute it on commercial facilities, on homes, and produce power from many different resources. And then, again, it's clean and renewable. Another piece on why that distributed power component is so important is, you remember the power outage we had here throughout the eastern United States, and I think that was 2005. I always hear this story, and Michigan State University often promotes this story on why they have a coal-fired power plant, but when everything went dark, and everything went dark all the way up to, I think, about the Lansing areas where things capped out, but Governor Granholm actually came to Michigan State University because the power plant we have here wasn't connected to the grid and didn't cascade with the rest of the power plants on the East Coast. So technically, Michigan State is distributed in a coal sense, in a weird sense there, but that instance shows why distributed power on a larger scale is very beneficial. It creates redundancy and it creates energy security so that in an instance like that, hopefully one day we're all producing our own power and we can feed it back onto the grid and prevent large economic and security threats such as that incident in 2005. So some of the negatives of solar, it is expensive, but costs are decreasing dramatically. It is what they call intermittent. So this, you always hear people say the sun doesn't shine all the time. And And the capacity factor, or how much energy you can produce from a solar panel, does decrease when it's cloudy and that sort of thing. But I'll explain a little bit later why some of those concerns can be dealt with. And it's also a very energy-intensive manufacturing process. So just to go back here, when I was talking about Hemlock Semiconductor, it's actually the largest consumer of electricity in the entire state. I know. Again, I'm just giving you things straightforward. No reason not to, right? And there, some utilities, consumers' energy, is actually pushing for the construction of a coal-fired power plant, one that would be 8 times larger than what we have here, in order to help produce these components at Hemlock Semiconductor. So it's, things aren't straightforward, you know. There's lots of gray area, but in the end, you know, this transition is going to be beneficial in the long run. This map just helps to address some of the concerns about Michigan not being able to produce enough solar energy. Now, of course, we don't have enough solar or as much solar capacity. And again, the colors are kind of weird here, but where it's black here in the bottom left-hand corner, it should be red. All right. But we actually have more solar radiance or more solar energy hitting every square foot of ground here in Michigan than they do have in Germany. But Germany is one of the top 2 markets for solar in the entire world. The figures that you can see below, in 1 year, Germany put on 1,500 megawatts of PV solar. And in the total PV solar throughout the entire state of our entire country is only 342 megawatts. So, I mean, it's not the technology isn't the problem. It's the policies that are put in place and the incentives in order to help get solar onto the market that are really the issue. And right now, we have a number of policy barriers that are preventing people like myself from putting a solar panel on my roof or putting a solar panel on your business or company and things of that nature. So just to talk real quickly about wind, new wind in Michigan is actually cheaper than new coal facilities. Again, we're not talking about old coal. We're talking about new coal. So it's through some of the recent figures, new wind, I heard, is as low as 6 cents a kilowatt hour to put a new wind farm online, where, again, an existing coal plant is 13 cents a kilowatt hour. So no longer can a utility make that argument that it's not more profitable and doesn't make sense for us, the consumers, to invest in renewable energy. If it's cheaper, then it makes sense for us. Offshore wind is a huge potential here in Michigan. So when you count just our onshore wind resources, Michigan has the 14th best wind capacity in the entire nation. But when you count our offshore wind resources, which is actually putting wind turbines in the Great Lakes, it moves us up to, and I can't remember the exact ranking, but I believe it's in the top 5 or top 7. And that's because when you put wind turbines out over the water, you have higher wind factors. You don't have trees, homes getting away, disturbing, creating turbulence for the wind. And you can put much larger turbines in the water as well. The issues with wind, some people in the room may be familiar with NIMBY, not in my backyard. We had a huge uproar regarding offshore wind turbines in the northwestern portion of the state. A company came in and proposed putting offshore wind turbines in Lake Michigan. Michiganders, we love our water, stood up, said hell no. And it really created a bad image for the production of offshore wind here in the state of Michigan. But you can definitely balance the visual impacts with the resource. I mean, these engineers are brilliant. They can put the wind turbines a certain mileage off so that you can barely see the wind turbine, so that it doesn't impact shipping, fishing lanes, doesn't impact bird and avian species. But again, it has to be a compromise with the community over these resources. And what I would say to many of those community members is would you rather have a coal-fired power plant in your neighborhood rather than one of these wind turbines offshore? Because that's what communities in Detroit, and that's what many of these lakeshore communities have to deal with every day as they wake up having to listen and see a coal-fired power plant on their coast. Yep.
Do they complain about turbines on land?
Yes.
They complain about any turbine.
Yes. The thing on land is that you can usually decrease that uproar by giving people money. So when a farmer in the Thumb gets a wind turbine placed on their land, they get payment or they get lease of that land per year. Where the big struggle of that was, where the big struggle recently on that has been is that if these are three plots of land, these chairs, and I place one wind turbine on this middle chair, usually it creates turbulence around that wind turbine and prevents those other two plots of land from putting wind turbines there. And utilities were only paying that guy. So, of course, those two people were talking about, well, I feel sick and I hear things and it's impacting my dog. And I'm saying that, you know, just kind of be funny, but there are valid concerns about wind turbines potentially impacting human health. But scientists are working on that, evaluating that, seeing the viability of producing new wind turbines that have no impact on human health or on sound quality and things of that nature. But what really has decreased those complaints has been payment to them. Maybe that's just a surprising correlation there. The other issue is wind resources aren't available everywhere. Mid-Michigan is not a very great place to put wind turbines. That's why you haven't seen them around this area. And also, wind is intermittent in terms of the wind isn't blowing all the time. But when you put wind turbines out over the water and when you put them out along the coast, I mean, we've all been to the beach. You know how strong the wind blows and how constant it often blows there. This graph, again, is just a visualization of what I was talking about before in terms of that black line across the top is, you can equate it to 13 cents a kilowatt hour for the production of electricity from an old coal-fired power plant. And these dots show the creation of new renewable energy facilities, mostly wind farms here in the state of Michigan and what the price points were for those. So, when we started, the utilities had wind turbines going up at about 14 cents a kilowatt hour. But just within the last year and a half, 2 years, that price has gone all the way down to 8. And again, I recently heard as low as 6. And that's because the utilities just know, they begin to learn who to buy materials from. They begin to have cheaper processes for putting up the wind turbines. It's just gained knowledge that, again, begins to reduce that cost. And the last one here before I quickly wrap up so that we can have some questions is energy efficiency, which is probably the place where we can gain the most in terms of not only jobs, but also having reduced carbon emissions and reduced emissions in general from fossil fuels. And it is currently the cleanest and cheapest and the fastest way to get at all those goals. Energy efficiency, you know, we think usually as being insulation, putting in double-pane windows and glass and things of that nature. But I actually, and this is what I want for Christmas, if I can somehow finagle myself in getting one. But in the future, energy efficiency, I think, is going to take on much more new and innovative realities for all of us. Right now, when you go home, many of us don't really have a connection to how much energy we're using. Like many other products we use, our microwave doesn't give us an output and say, yeah, maybe if you used, maybe if you bought dinner tonight instead of using the microwave, you would save that much in terms of electricity. Maybe if you didn't use your dryer, this is how much you're using each time you use that device. It's just very impersonal, very hard to understand how much all of our varied components in our home are using electricity and how much that's costing us. But recently, this product called Nest, which was developed by a former inventor of the iPod and the iPhone. He developed a device that, again, has that kind of aesthetic feel that an iPod or an iPad has. you know, those devices are great because they're just easy to use. They just start right up and start working and everything. But this device will actually sense when you're in the home, will adjust the temperature to your activities. The device will actually even, through Wi-Fi, look at weather trends, know when a cold front's coming in, know what the temperature might be, and actually adjust the temperature of your home that way. And it creates a learning, and it actually learns from how you interact in the home and how what are your activities, what time you go to sleep, and what time you go to work, and things of that nature. So I think in the future, energy efficiency is going to take on such a new and innovative possibilities that it'll become much easier for us to learn how we can save energy and in turn save money within our households. Right now, some of the reasons why energy efficiency is not moving forward like it should in the public sphere is because it's not sexy. Any of you have messed with fiberglass insulation? It's probably the unsexiest thing there ever was. It's itchy. It gets in your eyes. It's terrible stuff. And it also requires significant changes within the utility industry because now you have to work with the utility industry so that their mindset isn't, I make money off of selling you more power, so I need to somehow figure out a way for you to use as much as you can. But instead, their mindset is, what is the best way for you to meet all the needs that you have in your home, and how can I potentially save you money within your home, which is a different paradigm, but there are ways for the utility to make money off of that system. And the last quick three things here, these are kind of like game changers for renewable energy. One would be energy storage. So the actual largest investment that we have in terms of the entire clean energy economy here in Michigan is through advanced batteries. And that's because of the Volt in electric vehicles primarily, but also because of batteries that are being researched and energy storage devices that are being researched for the power grid. And that would change the whole dynamic. If you have sunlight shining in the day, you're able to store that sunlight to use during the evening or the nighttime hours or when it's cloudy. That changes that whole cost perspective and that whole equation on whether solar power or renewable or wind power is intermittent or not. The other thing is the use of smart grid, which is essentially how the grid interacts and talks with all the devices that are using power. So a smart grid concept would be like that thermostat, where it's actually interacting with the grid and helping explain to you how much power you're using and where are some opportunities for you to save electricity. And then also the passage of state and federal legislation and policies. The biggest thing is that we need to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions and on carbon in order for utilities to begin to internalize those external costs on the community. Again, right now, all those costs are being paid by all of us through healthcare, through natural disasters. And if you begin internalizing that cost into the price of carbon emissions, renewable energy better stacks up against those existing fossil fuel resources. So I'll take some questions. I apologize. I haven't talked about energy in a little while, so I'm a little rusty. But you guys, I guess, dealt with it okay. So any questions, conversation points? Go ahead. All right. No, I think she's scratching her head. So,
so what is Irma Civitas doing this?
Yeah. I'm kind of out on my own at the moment. No, what we're really doing is there's a number of communities across the state who see this as their new brand going forward. A community like Flint, our communities in Southeast Michigan, and a community like Detroit sees that going forward, one of their essential values or paradigm is going to be clean energy and is going to be working towards carbon neutral or working towards reduced greenhouse gas emissions in their communities. And they see that as a place not only a place economically where they can begin to attract new residents and new economic opportunities, but also just as an area where they can reposition themselves in the new economy. So I just heard this morning that Detroit just received, I think, $2.1 million to help develop, or Southeast Michigan, I should say, to help develop the advanced energy industry there in that area. Flint is doing really incredible things regarding advanced batteries and working on creating energy efficient communities and distributed energy sites. So that's where our role plays in, but those are some interesting developments in Michigan as well. Yes?
There's the 10% renewable standard coming up in, just over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
How are people on target for that? Because you showed a graph at the beginning of
about
10% was renewable, and you said most of that was hydro.
Yes, and so the thing with hydro and most of the renewable energy right now we get from hydro, from landfill gas, from biomass, but the things with those renewable energy resources is companies are actually taking down hydroelectric dams nowadays. Biomass is a set resource. You know, after you build a biomass plant to produce energy, you can only use so much wood resource around that plant to produce energy, and we only have so many landfills in the state. So all those things are kind of capped out. So that's why so much new capacity is shifting the wind. And right now, it is, from at least the reports that I've seen, very much on track to meeting the standards in 2015. And many organizations are actually looking to not only create a national renewable energy standard that would work across the entire country, but also looking at increasing that renewable energy standard in Michigan because, like I've said before, the cost is actually much lower than utility companies thought before, and this is something that creates jobs here in Michigan and creates further investment in an area that we didn't have investment before. Yeah, I should adjust what I said. In terms of, I'm talking much from the realm of utility capacity, very large facilities. There are some very large megawattage facilities that are devoted to biomass being created here in the state, but there's only a certain amount of capacity that can be attributed to those facilities because of the biomass resources that we have. When we're talking about distributed power, that's much different. And, you know, I would love if there was a policy where we could get anaerobic digesters on every farm and large farm here in the state of Michigan where they are producing their own resources, electrical and otherwise. So, yes?
I have sort of a general question and sort of a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, or at least with less of your knowledge, how much do you think the automotive industry, and not just the manufacturers, but anyone who drives a car contributes to anything automotive, how much of an effect do you think that plays into carbon emissions itself?
I just couldn't give you the exact number, and I don't want to lie to you to sound smart, but it is a significant equation to the carbon and to the greenhouse gas problem. I would say that the biggest problem is electrical generation, but undoubtedly oil and fossil fuels related to transportation are a huge issue, and that's why public transit. That's why the electrical vehicle industry is such a huge component there. But it's important that if we have electric vehicles that we are creating smart grids to understand how those vehicles can be connected to the grid and use energy more efficiently. And also, it's important that we have renewable energy and clean energy resources on the grid for those vehicles to use in the charge. Yeah. So that's why it's very important that those auto industries have to work with the utilities, because no longer are their worlds separate, which they pretty much have been before. Now their worlds are often intertwined, and that is causing a lot of headaches and such, because those are two quite immovable industries, if you can imagine, the utilities and the automobile industry. But it's going to create a lot of new, innovative, and exciting things going forward.
And then to follow up with that,
yeah.
Electric cars will obviously be more expensive compared to the old oil, gas that provides for the transmission we have now. Do you see a trend, such as like with the wind turbines, with those prices decreasing to help provide more affordable costs for those cars?
Yes. The cost of electric vehicles is obviously going to increase just with further production capacity and technology innovation on that end. I have no doubt that I couldn't tell you where the price point might be and whether or not it will be one-to-one competitive with the internal combustion engine. But the thing about thinking about the internal combustion engine is, again, if you were to incorporate all of the external cost of the internal combustion engine and emissions and things of that nature, then where would the price point be with electric vehicles? Undoubtedly, though, again, just giving you guys things honest and straightforward, electric vehicles and batteries do have their issues, too. We mine lithium from only a few places in the entire world, and those communities are therefore impacted by many of the same environmental impacts that are attributed to mining coal. So these decisions are going to be tough. There's going to be costs and benefits to every decision that we make going forward, but I hope all of it is moving us to a cleaner, healthier environment and one that respects our climate as well as one another. So, any other questions? All right.
Thanks.